This is what my fortune cookie said yesterday. Yeah, I think in the context of this group, we'll probably have people who agree with this and people who completely disagree with this. I probably belong to the second group. Never use proven methods and don't avoid shortcuts if you can do that. So yeah, Bridget asked me to come here and talk about the challenges and opportunities in cryo-ET. I allowed myself to modify this to cellular cryo-ET. This is what I mostly deal with. And most of the things that I'll be showing you come from my time as a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute in Martin Street with Wolfgang Baumeister. And so basically, this is coming back to Elizabeth's talk, where what we would like to do is image unperturbed molecular landscapes in cells and bring in these complex images of macromolecular complexes coming together to give rise to cellular function. Now, I will try to extend this notion of cellular function from simplified model systems such as HeLa cells in culture into whole model organisms and tissues. And so this is the list of questions that I got from Bridget. And basically, the first one is, what is next for these challenging methods? How hard will it be to do accurate 3D localization for site-specific perforations using the cryofib and then navigating the tomography data acquisition? Will super-resolution cryo-light microscopy become a reality? And will high-pressure freezing and fib lift-out become routine for bulk specimens? Now, for those of you who don't deal with tomography and cellular tomography, most of these probably mean nothing. The last question that was raised, how will we solve the segmentation problem? As I showed you, we come up with an immense amount of data, and we need to somehow interpret this data, and this is referred to as segmentation or annotation. And I guess Bridget was trying to be provocative and saying, how will deep learning methods, will they actually help, or are they just overhyped? So let's get rid of that last question. I'm not an expert in this, but I'll show you what this problem looks like. And so this is a data set that we published last year already, showing a nuclear periphery of a HeLa cell. So this is just a projection through a few slices. And I think you can appreciate the amount of information that is there. And I want to argue now that segmentation of these data in terms of molecular identity is quite a challenging problem. But lucky enough, Steve already talked about his deep learning methods and neuronal networks, showing beautifully how we can now do this in a simplified fashion and then extend these analyses into actual subtomogram averaging from in situ complexes. So thank you, Steve. And I don't think that they are overhyped. I think that they are the beginning of an exciting time of how to deal with these data. Another thing that I was very excited about, and I'll be curious to see how it will be related to cellular data, is the method that was discussed by Nico, and basically using high-resolution information to extract high-resolution molecular information from single projections. This might not seem trivial to you, but actually in many projects, we're not that much interested in looking at how different macromolecular complexes come together in three dimensions, but rather extracting accurate locations and positions of small macromolecular complexes. And this is just an example of one of these projects. This is a fib lamella through a rod outer segment. This is the structure that is responsible for your vision. And embedded in these very dense bilayer membranes, we have this small molecule, the rhodopsin photoreceptor, basically a 40 kilodalton protein fully embedded in the membranes. And I think in these types of data and these types of biological questions, it would be interesting to explore also these unusual perspectives. Okay, so now going back to the questions, what is next for these challenging methods? I get a feeling every time I give a talk, people say you make it sound very easy. So I'll just give you a perspective why these are still challenging. So Elizabeth already showed you sort of the workflow for sample preparation and image acquisition. I just want to point out what are still the challenges that we face. And they come up at every single level of this workflow. And so even starting with vitrification, most of us still deal with unicellular organisms or cell cultures, and we mostly use vitrification by plunge freezing. Now, this usually results in incomplete vitrification even for mammalian cell cultures. There, the nucleus is already on the order of 10 micrometers in diameter, and this is probably the limit that you can obtain vitrification using plunge freezing. Bob talked a lot about forces and shear forces coming from the process of blotting away the medium before you plunge freeze. Now, the forces that he described, that we actually generate during this process may not be enough to unfold a protein, but if we're looking at micron scale structures, they definitely do get deformed. So people who work on cilia and flagella know this very well. We've experienced this with many structures. And also trying to answer questions about cell biology, maybe how cells react to forces and so on. This is definitely a major challenge here. So once our samples are vitrified, we usually want to be able to locate an interesting event that we would be wanting to describe in structural at the structural level. And this is where we employ 3D correlative microscopy. Now, as Elizabeth mentioned, right now, to do 3D correlation, we do not have any commercial instruments available. The problem associated also with most cryo light microscopy setups that we have today, they're all done at atmospheric pressure. This is basically the only step of microscopy that we do is done basically at room conditions. And you can imagine how that is not extremely useful for cryo applications. And we usually are restricted to low resolution, the reason being that the sample has to stay vitrified to preserve the structural context. But we normally use air objectives, and these have to stay at room temperatures. So air objectives are limited by the numerical apertures, and so most of these applications are not high-resolution applications. They will not compete with what you can get with live cell imaging. Once we have localized the structure of interest, and we can do this despite the fact that we have all these limitations, the next step would be to thin down your sample to electron transparency. So we've talked about this, that we need our samples to be in the range of 200 to 300 nanometers in thickness. My favorite instrument is the cryofocused ion beam for various reasons. What I mostly like about it is that it can be done in a site-specific manner, and the thickness can be controlled pretty well. Again, the challenges here, that most systems that are used today are just basically homemade or heavily modified systems. The stages and imaging conditions suffer from horrible instability. There is a lot of problems such as condensation related within the microscope itself. So this is a huge chamber compared to the TEMs that we use. It's also the cryo shielding is very different and so on. So we suffer a lot from these problems of condensation. Cryo always brings in more complications. So it's actually pretty difficult to have precise control over thickness. Conductivity of these samples is something that we need to deal with as well. And the last point, which now is starting to really bug me, at the beginning it was kind of fine to sit the whole day at the FIB. Nowadays, I'm just bored. These are extremely time-consuming preparations, and I think this is what is limiting us in terms of throughput. But once you've prepared a sample, you will take it to the Titan Cryos. And now with all the wonderful tools and toys that we have on our cryoses, using an energy filter for tomography, we particularly like the K2 direct detectors. And I particularly like the faceplate, despite of Rado's comments on this. Nevertheless, doing a fully automated acquisition on FIB lamellas is quite challenging, so automated acquisition is particularly tricky. This is not where it ends. Then comes in the whole the whole story of how to process this data. And obviously, I mean, if we're still not there with routine pipelines for single particles, we're obviously not there for cryotomography and subtomogram averaging. So there are very good ideas coming up from the whole community about the dose weighting for tomograms, 3D CTF applications. In fiblamellas, we do not have fiducials. These are strictly inside cells, and so alignment of tilt series still, I think, remains a bottleneck for the achievable resolution that we can have. I've mentioned how to localize structures of interest. Nowadays, it's mostly done by template matching. Again, very consuming, time-consuming. And then 3D averaging, alignments and averaging are still kind of in development. So again, we have very few packages that really combine this into a streamlined process. So despite the fact that FEI, now Thermo Fisher, killed the project of the correlative microscopy, they did finally come up with a product that is now released, and I happen to be the lucky person who got that first product. They did actually do quite nice work on this with respect to the prototype that they had before. So now the chamber pressure is much better. This has to do with different modifications that they applied to the turbo system and so on. They now integrated a platinum sputtering inside the chamber. This is particularly important for conductivity. And this is actually the first lamella that I prepared in this microscope. So actually for an out-of-the-box solution, which I expected to be horrifying, it's actually not so bad. So they did come up with a very good stage stability and temperature stability. The vacuum is much better, so we suffer less from contamination issues. And maybe this really opens the path to now think about automation and high throughput of these preparations. But to do that, we really need to know better about how these preparations will go in the instrument. So one issue that we realized quite early in Martin's read is that you can prepare a beautiful lamella, but the longer you keep it inside the microscope, the more buildup you will have. Again, the vacuum in these large chambers is not that great. And we were able to actually measure these condensation rates once we started applying a thin platinum sputtered layer on top of the lamellas. And so from this, you can see this is where the lamella cross-section ends. This is where the platinum ends. And this lamella was just incubated in the chamber for a maximum of an hour. And so here you already get a 45 nanometer condensation of pure water on top of your lamella, effectively increasing your sample thickness. And so imagine, I mean, at the beginning we were happy and that we can prepare lamellas, and we used to prepare five of these. That would mean that the first lamella would stay in the chamber for about 5 hours. And so at the end of the day, you would get a beautiful lamella, but then about 300, 400 nanometers more condensation on top of that.
I have a question. The lower panel where it says platinum sputter.
Yeah.
I'm having difficulty seeing it, and now that I think I see it, it seems to be more electron transparent than some of the other features. Is that the way you see it as well? And if so, it doesn't seem right to me.
Yes, it doesn't seem right to you. It is an extremely thin platinum layer, and I think that it's basically, we look at these structures and they looked extremely electron dense because we're projecting through these continuous structures. This is why we get a very high contrast for these. Whereas the platinum is there as a very thin layer, and it does look fainter than what you would expect. Now, just to give you a comparison, this is how the platinum layers would look on just pure ice. Here they look very electron dense, right?
So I have a question. If you've got this condensation, can you just mill it off? And then.
But that means, again, leaving the samples inside the chamber, and in the time that you're milling one, you're polishing one sample. During that time, the other samples are, again, building up more of this condensation.
Well, we do cleaning, what we call at the end of the day, but you still quite can't escape it because you have to go for a while and
exactly, and this is why it is important to at least know how your microscope behave and how much condensation you're building up, and this is exactly what we've been trying to do with the new instrument. Very boring experiments, but very important, where we just put a thin PBS grid inside with sputter, and then we'll incubate, and then we sputter again and incubate. That way we can get these very accurate measurements of condensation rate. It seems to be that on the new instruments, the condensation rates can be extremely high. So these are still issues that we need to deal with.
What kind of vacuum do you think would be needed in order to lower these? What vacuum is this at right now?
This is at 10 to 3 times 10 to the minus 7 millibars. So the vacuum here is actually, can you hear me? The vacuum here is actually much better than on the old systems, but I think that this will be significantly reduced more with better cryo traps rather than trying to get the vacuum higher. Yes?
Oh, I have a question about the vacuum. Is the vacuum level, is that with it warm? Like before you cool it?
No, what cold. That's cold.
What was it before you cooled it?
It's one order of magnitude lower. The pressure is...
So it's 3 times minus 6 or
something? Yeah, yeah. So the stage and the cryotrap do help to get to higher vacuum levels. Nevertheless, you still have a partial pressure of water inside the microscope, and that's what condenses on the samples. Yeah, so anyway, understanding these rates is what's going to help us get into a realm where we can think about throughput, right? Because if we would mill 5 or 6 lamellas on a single grid, you would end up building 3 nanometers per minute. A single lamella of a mammalian cell takes about an hour, and so 6 hours incubations inside the chamber will result in a lot of condensation. So this is the wrong way to go, of course. I do believe that, yes, we can bypass this by, again, polishing all the lamellas at the end, but then still, it does require time. So we do need to try to minimize this by figuring out where this actually comes from, why do we sometimes get 3 nanometers per minute, and how to reduce this. Again, I think cryotraps will be a much better solution in this case. The second thing is, a lot of people that I talk to about automation say, how do you actually know where to stop, right? These samples do charge, and the imaging conditions are not extremely precise, but then we can use the differential voltage imaging inside the SEM to actually determine what the thickness should be, and this is how we decide where to stop. So if you image in the lamella during the preparation, you can actually get differential contrast inside the lamella depending on which voltage you're using. And so with a higher voltage, 5 kV in this case, I also use higher voltages, I'm not scared of it, because then the electrons will basically are more likely to go through your sample, and you will get more transparency in these cases. You see here at 5 kV, at this 150 thick lamella, it actually looks kind of black. What you see is white here is at the front. This is the organometallic platinum coating that we apply. This is, by now, I think, a normal procedure to protect the front of the lamella and get these homogeneous thicknesses. So here you see that the lamella is almost transparent at this stage with the 5 kilovolts, but with the 3 kilovolts, you still get some internal contrast from the cellular structures. And so I think that characterizing these behaviors correlated to the thickness of the lamellas will also help us to get into a state where we can actually say, okay, this lamella is already to 150 nanometers thick. This is what I'm looking for, and this is where I should stop. So yeah, I think that characterizing these things will help us a lot to move into the realm of automation and high throughput. And then comes Bridget's next question. What if you're not just trying to randomly millet cell and look at any molecular landscape in here. And so Bridget asks, so how hard will it be to actually pinpoint in three dimensions a specific structure that you would like to look at, target that with a fib, so make sure that that structure is retained within the lamella, and then actually acquire data at that specific state. And so I want to decouple these two parts of the questions. So the first part has to do with targeting. And what I want to point out is that we actually don't need high resolution. We need high precision to locate things. So we can live with the low numerical aperture objectives if we know how to handle this process. Now, for the tomography acquisition data, this is where we would like to move into high and maybe even super resolution light microscopy. And there it is because we do want to be able to say we acquired a tomogram at that specific location and my molecule or structure of interest is positioned within that field of view in that position. And so what I've been working on together with Jan Arnold, a master's student in Martens Reed, is to solve that first question. So we were developing 3D correlative approaches for first imaging your vitrified sample in the fluorescent light microscope, and then correlating that to the EM data, the EM data being in the FIB-SEM dual beam microscope. And this is specifically to target structures that we're interested in and maintain them within the lamella. And so these are a list of conditions that we set for ourselves in developing this microscope. This was actually the development of the core site and the whole pipeline of sample preparation and data processing that comes with it. So obviously, we need to keep our samples vitrified. That means that we do want to get very close with the objective, but maintain those temperature below the devitrification temperature. To get proper imaging, because what we're doing right now is actually acquiring stacks rather than single images. This was done in a confocal, spinning disc confocal microscope. And so we couldn't afford very large thermal or mechanical drifts of the stage. And so actually that microscope was designed in a way where cooling was done passively rather than actively to avoid these drifts. As I said, this is the only microscopy that we do at atmospheric pressure, and so your sample is basically not protected from the surrounding atmosphere and the water in there. And so it took us some time to figure out how to avoid frosting during this process. I already mentioned the spinning disc confocal microscopy. This also helps the sensitivity of the microscope. It definitely reduces the background from what we're used to seeing in white field systems. And then what we reasoned is that we can still live with these low resolution data by basically using fiducial markers to overcome the resolution limit. Now, this has already been described by John Briggs' lab and Kai Grunewald's lab, where they used fiducial markers and basically fit their centers very precisely, and that way achieve high localization. We also developed the computational aspects of this coordinate transformation. This is not a simple 2D to 2D transformation. Nevertheless, it was quite straightforward treating this as a rigid body problem and basically taking 3D spinning disk data and translating that into the 2D topographic images that we got in the SEM. And so the one problem that we couldn't deal with at the time, because that was not related to the microscope, is your ability to do this very precisely, despite the fact that you've prepared good samples, acquired good light microscopy data, calculated the coordinate transformation, but then when you're sitting on the fib and trying to prepare a lamella at the position that you decided you should, this poor stage stability and imaging stability would basically not allow you to do this routinely. And so constant drift during the milling or drifts in the imaging conditions would actually preclude this possibility to do this accurately. Okay, so, but I'll show you how to do this because this is a general aspect of how to deal with these types of problems of 3D correlation for targeted milling. This is not related to a specific microscope, so whoever wants to develop and build their own microscope is more than welcome to use these general aspects. We came up with fiducial markers that would help us distinguish them in the SEM. What you need to remember, when you do a light microscopy to a TM correlation, then it's actually very simple to distinguish electron-dense beads in the TM, even if they're embedded within that thin ice layer. This is not the case in SEM imaging, or FIB imaging, for that matter, because once you have the beads embedded inside the thin layer, you basically don't have any signal from them. And so we came up with a procedure where we use fiducial markers that are actually polystyrene beads but are enriched in magnetite. Magnetite having iron in it is electron dense, and so you can actually use backscattered electrons in the SEM chamber to distinguish what is a fiducial marker that you deposited versus a contaminant ice crystal right here. We do tend to use more the fiducials that are on the grid bars. That still gives you a field of view that you can then easily correlate and precisely correlate between the fluorescence light microscopy and the cryofib imaging. And again, these very different views that you get from the SEM, always looking from the top, these are very easy to correlate. But then once you look at the FIB image that is done from a shallow angle, then this, of course, complicates things. Nevertheless, using these fiducials, picking them here and here, you do not need to make any assumptions, any a priori assumptions about how is this coordinate transformation done, and you basically can just calculate this from the algorithms that Vlad and Lucic came up with. And so, again, we're still restricted in resolution. I think our best case estimation is about even 600 nanometers. That's the resolution that we calculated. Using the fiducials, and the more fiducials we use, the higher the accuracy, we can see that even with six fiducials in our field of view, most of our correlations fall in within that range of 200 nanometers, which then allows us to really prepare a lamella at the site that we identified as being interesting. Now, it actually turned out to be much better with cells because then we are particularly picky about areas that we would like to look at. And so this is just a demonstration on HeLa cells. In this case, we introduced an external fluorescent dye for different lipids. And what you see here inside the circles are these fiducial markers. They are easily identified in the SEM image. A bit more difficult in the FIB image, but the nice thing about all of this is that Jan then incorporated this into a very straightforward GUI that you can then do online while sitting at the FIB. Basically, you have the light microscopy data already available. You could acquire that on a different day. And then you acquire your FIB image at the location, at the rough location of that area of interest. And then basically clicking on these markers, you get a list and you start minimizing the errors in fitting these markers between the two data sets. And I think, so the fitting of the signal in Z, so the center of this fiducial is done automated there, and you can really go into minimizing the errors and come up with resolutions that are on the range, with correlations that are on the range of tens of nanometers. Once you prepare your lamella, you obviously want to then do TM imaging. And this is just to show you that we can actually use these initial data that we acquired from whole cells in three dimensions and then calculate a second coordinate transformation, basically taking that original volume and overlaying it on the TM lamella. And so this is what would allow you then to distinguish where you want to actually acquire your tomography data. Now, This is fine for structures that we were trying to target here. These are large lipid droplets. But you can imagine that if you were trying to look at much smaller structures, that would be extremely difficult. And this is where super resolution microscopy should come into play. And so Bridget asked, will it actually become a reality? Well, it is already kind of a reality, probably not a routine one. But we had several demonstrations already in 2014, 2015, using basically quite available cryostages. So none of these used any home-built cryostages. And they basically managed to apply either photoactivated localization microscopy or single molecule localization microscopy using genetically encoded fluorescent proteins. And that was, at the beginning, surprising to many people, but they actually characterized these photoactivatable GFPs, or Venus in this case, and they showed that they can actually localize things maybe even at higher precision at cryogenic temperatures. This is because they bleach less, and they're actually much brighter under cryogenic conditions. So that was a very promising start. Nowadays, what I find very exciting is that many people from the super resolution field are coming into this cryo realm. So people who are interested in getting the best optics possible are finally realizing that cryopreservation is actually the best way to preserve your biological structure. This is a recent paper that came up. Here, they're really focusing on the super resolution light microscopy part. They don't care that much about the cryopreservation, but nevertheless, they came up with a design that allows you to use an immersion room temperature lens. So now really boosting up the numerical aperture and using room temperature numerical apertures by this interesting design, I would call it. So it is truly an immersion objective, kept at room temperature, but imaging a cryo grid. Not sure how this would actually preserve structures at the molecular level, because they do use an organic solvent for immersion that will probably exchange the water in your specimen. But I think that these are directions, interesting directions, that people are starting to explore. And just to show you here, they already apply two-color palm, and they do show that it's really much better resolved at cryo temperatures, which is, again, very surprising. Now, there are many groups that are working on really applying this for correlative microscopy between light microscopy and electron tomography specifically. So Rainer Kaufmann in Heidelberg, and then David Hoffman, together with Harald Hess and Eric Betzig, are working on their own design. Unfortunately, nothing is published yet, so I can't really show you, but I heard them talk about this very often. Okay, so the next question is, can't see how I'm doing with time. Okay.
We have 15 minutes, I think.
Okay. So the next question was, will high-pressure freezing and FIB lift-out become routine for bulk specimens? Now, who cares? Most of us manage to work beautifully with selected thin cells, or extract the molecules or the structures that we want to look at. Why would we even care about high-pressure freezing? And then we come back to our ultimate objective, which is structural preservation, right? And we've been talking about this a lot. Yes, it's awesome that we can obtain high-resolution structures from pre-orified macromolecular complexes, but it would be very interesting to actually be able to do this inside the cell, right? And so, as I said, what we all do is plunge freezing. So we freeze the sample so quickly that ice crystals cannot be formed. But again, these are limited to a few micrometers. And I mentioned at the beginning that even with HeLa cells, you already can get devitrification deep inside the cell. And so that is already a limitation. The second issue being is not everything, just to add complexity to issue, right? Not everything can be simplified. Not every biological question can be simplified into a cell culture system. Many processes, such as development or disease, happens in tissue, and you cannot really model that in a cell culture. And so this is where high-pressure freezing comes in. And so basically, we apply 2,000 bars to the sample before we actually freeze it. Now, this is done so quickly that the sample actually does not have time to change due to this pressure. But what happens is that the water molecules under this pressure would freeze at lower temperatures. And now this allows us access to about 200 micrometers thickness. And this is a realm where we can start thinking about tissue biopsies or model organisms that we would like to look at. And so, again, just to show you what not that greatly vitrified cellular specimen looks like, this is a lamella from Mahela cells. You can all identify the annoying ice crystals that got deposited during transfers. And actually, this is a lamella where we acquired very nice data sets. The thing is, we acquired them really just at the periphery of the cell. And this has a very homogeneous gray texture to it. Now, if you look here inside at the center here, you'll see these black and white reflections. And these are actually crystalline reflection from the ice that did form, the ice crystals that did form inside the cell. So this is how the specimens look like initially, right? These are HeLa cells plunge frozen on a TEM grid. And now if we say this is a problem because we don't get vitrification, but then you try to do this with high pressure freezing, and this is the type of sample that you achieve. And so basically, whereas here you can identify the cell that you're interested in, it's very nicely exposed on the surface. If you want to do fib milling, and this is what Elizabeth already showed you before, you basically need to remove material above and below an area of interest. Maybe you've already identified that using the correlative microscopy. And even this on a mammalian cell takes an hour. Now imagine doing this on this 200 micrometer thick high-pressure frozen sample. I've tried it. It took 3 days, and at the end of it, you end up damaging your sample due to the beam that you actually put on it. And so we had to come up with a different strategy to deal with this, and this is where the lift-out part of that question comes in. And so in the lift-out, what we do, we don't try to remove all the material within that huge volume and that huge surface, but we rather focus on the area that we're interested in. Then we would remove material just around it, and then we create these thin slabs. At this stage, they're about 5 micrometers in thickness. And then by tilting the sample, we can completely detach this thin slab from the bulk high-pressure frozen specimen. Now, before you detach it, you should actually attach a micromanipulator. And this is very routinely done in material science applications, so we did not invent anything new here rather than just figuring out how to keep this whole procedure under cryogenic temperatures. And so the micromanipulator here is cooled down by the cryotrap in the microscope, actually. It's attached to that slab of frozen material by depositing a little bit of propane gas. Then once this slab is attached to the micromanipulator, it's completely detached from the sample, transferred all the way from your bulk specimen into a second carrier, and they're inserted into these thin slits that we prefabricate. This is where this now 5 micrometer thick slab is thinned down to electron transparency. And at the time, we could show that this actually does maintain vitrification. You could do this for a few areas in a day, right? We're working with a very large specimen. It's about 3 millimeters in diameter, so we have options to do this multiple times. But then we were stuck. We could not get this into actual cryotomography, and new efforts by Miroslava Scheffer, and now in collaboration with Kleindig, which they produce now a commercially available micromanipulator. It's actually a gripper type of micromanipulator, so you don't need to do these attachments. I'll show you the data later. And so now we really aimed for doing a site-specific preparation. This is a demonstration on C. elegans worms. So now using our 3D correlative setup, we can actually acquire fluorescence data. beforehand, and the fluorescence data is quite actually astonishing. When I got these images first, you would expect a lot of scattering from these specimens. Nevertheless, you can actually identify different tissues. So this is a germline, for example. This is the gut. Here are the embryos. And then once the sample is inserted into the FIB-SEM, this is how the surface looks like, right? But we can then calculate the coordinate transformation. In this case, it's only done in 2D because we're going to be digging straight into the sample. So we don't really need the third dimensions in this correlation. And this is the movie that is going to show you exactly how that is done. So now we identify the areas of interest. We mill these trenches. You come in with this gripper type of micromanipulators, and you basically grip that thin slab. Once it's held, you mill away that remaining material and basically completely remove that slab into a different carrier, again, prefabricated slits, and this is where we thin down that sample. Does look like science fiction, but it actually works. It actually works and actually preserves the structure. So these are tomograms. I'm sorry about the contrast here. These are tomograms from C. elegans worms. And just to confirm that we do not damage the structures, we basically picked up all the ribosomes as a benchmarking test. And then average them, and this is the average that we get. So this was acquired without a faceplate, so we could just plug in into the Reliant pipeline and get this average. The reported resolution is about 12 angstroms from that single data set, so I think we're quite confident that things are not going completely to hell. Yeah, so I think I showed you it's feasible. The question was, could it become routine? Yes. I think the real question is it going to happen anytime soon? Now, I actually think that at this point, the lift-out procedure itself is not the bottleneck. As I said, in these cellular preparations, every single step in the pipeline has to be absolutely perfect. And there are other issues that come into place. So for example, milling these initial trenches, you need to remove quite a substantial amount of material. Once you start digging into the specimen, you start getting redeposition of the material. This is, again, all done in cryo conditions. This is completely different behavior than what material scientists do for room temperature. And so I think that coming up with just bulk specimen polishing procedures before the lift out, and coming up with faster milling sources, so oxygen, for example, can be used as a source. This will reduce the time that we need to spend before we actually do the lift out. But then we need to come up with solutions for fabricating these carriers, making sure that they're not charging, and come up with reliable attachment of the lamella to the carriers. And I'm done. Yeah, so I just want to thank everyone at the Baumeister department. Wolfgang was kind enough to host me there for quite some time. Jürgen Plitzko is a great colleague to play with all these new instrumentation, very exciting. A lot of help from Miroslava Scheffel for the cryofib lift-out approaches. A lot of collaboration with both companies that do produce cryofibsem. So Andreas Schertl from Zeiss, this is data that I actually did not show. But Ruud Champers from FEI is really one of the key players in developing these new cryofib products. Radostein for all the help on the faceplate, although again, I did not show that much. Processing, yes, we still do a lot of this in a very, dark ages, somebody mentioned. And then, yeah, a lot of people for other projects. And thank you for your attention.
Wow, just in case we thought we were going to run out of challenges in the next few years.
Hey, Ilya. About the lift out portion, at least this initial trench milling, couldn't it be automated in a kind of straightforward way? Because I guess you mill for a preset amount of time with the preset beam setting. So you just say here, 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 and here.
Yes.
Then you come back and you have already the trenches, and then you could, I guess, the lift out itself has to have a human being there and controlling it. But Definitely. Is that already being automated or?
Not yet. Nothing is being automated yet. I think for all the rough milling steps, even for the regular on-the-grid lamellas, the rough milling steps can definitely be automated. The lift out for sure. This just takes a day to prepare all these trenches and then that.
How much time that will save compared to the whole procedure? Half of the time or?
Well, I think it's, you know, the automation will save some time. I'm not sure it's going to be that much time saving. I think it saves a lot of man time, which can be substantial. And also my feeling, my personal feeling is once you get things automated and you don't invest that much effort and time into actually sitting there, you care less if one of them fails. and so I do think that we'll be able to experiment more and get more samples. That's good.